The Sunstone Foundation presents Personal Perspectives on International Development, recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We take you now to the University of Utah campus, where the program is about to begin.
We have four people on our panel, and we're missing one. We don't know if the plane got hijacked between here and where he lives up on the hill or what happened, but we hope he shows up. On our panel today, we're talking about personal perspectives on international development, and we have a group of people who have participated in international development projects, and we'd like to share some reflections. And one thing I might say before we start is that there were many people, actually, that wanted to participate on this panel. However, third world people in the church and third world development are a fairly elusive group, and the others that aren't here that wanted to participate are all out of the country doing some kind of development project somewhere. And actually, on our panel here, Dave just flew in from Bolivia yesterday, and Jim, the one who's missing, is flying out to Egypt in a couple of days. And so we're kind of just catching people as they're coming and going. As by way of introduction, I'm Tricia Ormsby, and I'm the moderator for the panel, and I have worked in third world development sorts of situations for a number of years. The area that I've worked the most in is Asia, but also Central America and Africa. And currently I teach down at BYU in the Home Economics Department. Some people wonder how home economics and international development, what do they have to do with each other? And actually have a lot. The thing that I do particularly is work on the problems that households face. For example, nutrition, health problems, lack of education, those types of situations, and work to develop programs around those. Also on our panel today, we have Kristen Holbrook over here in the green, and she is graduate of the U. We're sitting here at her alma mater, and she is currently the executive director of the Wolesebugu Alliance, which is a service organization based in Salt Lake dealing with the country of Africa. Wolesebugu is a region of Mali, and she is the director of the program there that is working to benefit Mali. And our commentator today is David Knowlton, and Dave teaches currently at Washington University in St. Louis. He teaches anthropology, and he's had many, many years of experience in the Andean region of South America, particularly Peru and Bolivia. And he'll give us some comments on our panel today. The person that's not here yet is Jim Mayfield, who is a professor here at the U in political science and has worked for many years on development projects, assessing development projects in areas throughout the world. Particularly Egypt is his specialty, but also Indonesia, Sri Lanka, areas in Asia, in the Middle East. What I'd like to do today is start off and kind of give an overview of some of the issues that we can might think about with third world development and being members of the church and how those two work together and some of the things that we may want to think about. And I have to tell you how the idea for this panel started. And that is last year, Dave and I were on a panel for Sunstone on third world sisters. And we looked at some of the problems, particularly of women in the church who live in the third world. And as we got to the question and answer period, one of the very first questions was, why isn't the church doing something to help the people in the third world? Now, this question has stuck in my mind a long time for a couple reasons. One is, the first assumption was the church was not doing anything. It was phrased in the negative, why isn't the church doing something? And the church is doing something, and I thought that was interesting that was the way that whole question was phrased. And the second thing is, it caused me to think, what should the church be doing? What are some of the directions that the church as an institution and also the church as a collection of individuals ought to or could be or whatever doing in this issue of development in the third world? So I think that this is kind of an extension then of that question. And maybe we can rephrase it into, instead of why isn't the church doing something, into what is the church doing and why is it doing it and how can it perhaps be done to a better extent. Okay, one of the questions then we first need to address is, what is international development? What are we talking about? Basically, international development is an attempt to alleviate some of the suffering and improve the quality of life for people in the third world. And we're talking... when we talk about the third world, we're talking about basically three-quarters of the households of the world are families that live in the third world. And I think we're all familiar with the kinds of situations that they encounter. We've all seen the documentaries on TV and that sort of thing, showing the hunger and some of the real difficulties that families and individuals face. Just an example, there are lots of ways that academicians have measured this. What I've got here is a chart, the Human Suffering Index. Okay, and talking about, it's got a little map down here, and everything that's in red and orange, which is about half of South America here, all of Africa, the Middle East, Southeast Asia, many parts of Asia, are considered to be areas where people are suffering greatly. They categorize it as extreme human suffering and high human suffering in these areas. And whereas the green areas, which we fall right in the middle of in much of Europe and Australia and USSR, would be places where people can live comfortably without suffering. So these are the areas of the world that we're talking about when we talk about international development, is these areas where there really is a lot of hardship and suffering. Now, we're really taught little in the church as far as directions to take, as far as our participation in what's going on in the rest of the world and the kinds of things we can do. And I think it's one of these things that's left up to our own initiative and our own desires and thoughts. One of the things that, I think is maybe increasing our awareness as a church, as an institution, of what's happening in the third world is the number of missions and the number of missionary efforts that are being directed toward third world countries now. For example, in Africa now, we have missions in Zaire, Nigeria, Ghana, South Africa, Zimbabwe, the British Isles of Africa, Kenya, Ivory Coast, Liberia, Mauritius, Sierra Leone, La Reunion, Guinea, Liberia, Mascarene Islands, and we have a church presence now in China, Burma, and India. So that as we read through, you know, see the things that come out of the church news or the Ensign or, what, you know, hear reports from people in our wards that are being called on missions, a lot of times they're in really far, far away places, places where we have not previously had missionaries. And so it's, I think this is bringing it to our attention more and more, the fact that there really are a lot of people in this world that we haven't had much contact with before, and they are areas where lives are much different than what we know now, the ones that we're familiar with. Okay, what kind of... So we go back to thinking about, in the church, what kind of encouragement is there to be associated with things related to third world development? One of the things I did is to look through the scriptures first, okay? Lots and lots of references towards taking care of the poor. In the Bible, they were, you know, I don't love to count things, but just to give you an idea, in the Bible there are 48 references to taking care of the poor. And I think one of the things that's particularly applicable to our discussion today is the one verse in Mark that says, where Christ is talking, he says, "For the poor you will always have with you." Okay, so that is one condition of this earth, is there will be people who are poor. And there are also, in the Book of Mormon, there are 12 references, in the Doctrine and Covenant 15. So this theme comes up many, many times, that there are poor of the earth, and it is our responsibility to do what we can to help those poor. And I think that that becomes very clear, particularly in Mosiah and in Alma. There are many references towards the poor. One I'd like to read is in Alma 1:27. And this is describing the people of Nephi. "And they impart their substance, every man according to that which he had, to the poor and the needy and the sick and the afflicted. And thus, in their prosperous circumstances, they did not send away any who were naked or that were hungry or that were athirst or that were sick or that had not been nourished, whether out of the church or in the church, having no respect to persons as to those who stood in need." I think in two of the key issues there is helping to take care of those in need, and the last part, too, having no respect of persons, whether they were members of the church or not members of the church. This is the way the people of Nephi were living at that point. They were giving to all who had need, whether or not they were in the church or out of the church. So there are... many examples then of giving to those in need. And there also are, we've had comments by different church authorities about the integration then of our spiritual lives and our temporal lives. Joseph Fielding Smith said once, "You must continue to bear in mind that the temporal and the spiritual are blended. They are not separate. One cannot be carried on without the other as long as we are here in mortality. The Latter-day Saints believe not only in the gospel of spiritual salvation, but also in the gospel of temporal salvation." So in other words, this idea of connectedness of our temporal being and our spiritual being is really a high connection. And I think that that would be a wonderful topic to discuss sometime in greater length. But I think it's just something to keep in mind here as we talk about doing what we can in the third world here today. Now, so that's some of the kind of the scriptural basis of this idea of helping in the third world. Looking at the programs the church has established, I think one that we can go to and we think of probably quite readily when we talk about giving to those in need would be the welfare program. And the church welfare program established in 1935 after some of the effects of the Depression and with a lot of the members of the church in great need. There were a lot of other incidences before in church history, though, where people gave but not as an organized group to help those in need. Some of the principles of the welfare program as it was established were that it would be based on giving through love, giving service to those in need, so love, service, working for what you receive, work, self-reliance, trying to become as self-reliant as possible, consecration of goods and energy, time and energy to the church, and stewardship over those things which we have responsibility for. So the welfare program then was built on six principles of how we can help not only ourselves, but how other people can help themselves also. Now, carrying that one step further, we've had recently initiated in the church is a church humanitarian services committee. Now, this committee was established in 1985, and it was in response to the famines in Ethiopia. I'm sure you remember the fast that we had. The letter that went out from the First Presidency at the time of the fast was that from the funds donated through the fast, the funds would be dedicated for the use of victims of the famine and other causes resulting in hunger and privation among the people of Africa and possibly in some other areas. In the letter, it promised that all funds contributed will assist the hungry and the needy in distressed areas regardless of church membership. And with that fast, the church gathered together almost $11 million. And to me, that when I first heard that figure, I was just astounded. But I thought that I think this really shows that many, many members of the church really want to help, and they're perhaps stymied on how is an appropriate way to help. And there was some security knowing that the church was responsible for these funds and that they would be handled in a way that it was at least somewhat under our, you know, somebody's watch and care. And I think it also showed that really among members of the church there's a great deal of feelings of wanting to help and wanting to do something to cause better things to come to pass for many of the poor people of the world. Since the contribution of that money, much of the money was sent to Ethiopia to help with the famine there. But then there was leftover money, and so with this leftover money, they started several development projects in different parts of the world, particularly in Africa, but also in South America. And I don't know if any of you remember, but it was in August of '88. There was a major article in the Ensign about some of the projects that were going on. One was growing trees in parts of Niger that were having problems with wind erosion, well and water distribution delivery systems in Chad. They've got several things going in Zaire. There's some things going on in Bolivia in the Altiplano area, in different areas of the world. And this is, a major step forward in helping the church and also members of the church individually recognize some of the great needs that are in different parts of the world and ways that things can be done to help. One of the things I think is very admirable about this, there are many groups in the world trying to do international development projects with varying degrees of success. In fact, probably the majority do not succeed in the long run. They may show some promise right up front, but trying to sustain them over several years is very difficult. But the director of the Humanitarian Services Fund for the Church, I know that he tries to go by these principles of welfare services, tries to make people, help them be self-reliant, make them have an opportunity to work for some of the things that they're receiving and that sort of thing. So I think that it's in some cases it's not necessarily unique. Other people have tried it too, but trying to keep that philosophy throughout, I think, will be really a great benefit. Now, this is the humanitarian service projects are being looked after by several of the general authorities who go and periodically looked after the sites. One thing that Elder Bishop Pace said after a visit to some of the projects in Africa, he says, our contributions have helped people irrespective of their political affiliation. When I walked the land, I didn't see communists, Marxists, or capitalists, but hungry people, all sons and daughters of God. And that's kind of the philosophy behind this, is they're not directing it only towards church members. And in many cases, there are not church members in the areas that these projects are going into, but there are areas that are in great need, and they're chosen for their need. Currently, since the church doesn't have a huge amount of money, I mean, not by any means compared to some of the development agencies like AID and CARE and some of the really big groups, that it has to be limited. And so right now the church is limiting their humanitarian projects to life-threatening situations. The first one is acute life-threatening situations like emergencies brought on by natural disasters that require immediate direct relief. Or the second priority that they have is chronic debilitating conditions brought about by poverty, poor health, or unsafe environments. So the second thing would be then to look for situations where, for example, there is no safe supply of water. And so the people are continually getting sick from contaminated water, and there's just no way out except improving water supply somehow. So that would be an example of a chronic debilitating condition. So this is kind of a slight background here on some of the things that the church has done and perhaps why we as members of the church ought to think about or be involved in international development type projects. Now, right now we'll have some of the other panelists comment. Kristen, is, as I said, works with the Wolesa Bugu Alliance, and she's going to share with us some of her ideas about development as she has worked. This is her occupation now, working directly with an international development relief kind of organization. And then we'll go from there. I think either we'll have David comment, or if Jim shows up, we'll have Jim. Okay, thank you.
Okay, as Tricia mentioned, my name is Kristen Holbrook, and I work for the Wolesa Bugu Alliance. Tricia is also one of the board members of the Alliance and serves as our development committee head person. First of all, I'd like to tell you how I got involved with development. I didn't know I was getting involved with international development, but more so I wanted to help people, and basically that was structured into international development, specifically the people in Africa. And it was just something that was inherent in me when I was very young and something that I wanted to do when I grew up. And I was a poli-sci major up here at the university, and through some events that happened, I just kind of got tunneled into that, and I'm, you know, glad that I have. One thing that I'd like to mention about the Wolesa Bugu Alliance, which you know, Tricia pointed out, that over on the other side of the spectrum in these third and fourth world countries, there is no, that you don't see religion and you don't see, you know, their political views or anything. But we went to the LDS church about 3 years ago and asked for some money, and one thing that they really thought was unique and wonderful about the Alliance is that It was not something that was suggested from the pulpit. It was a group of people from this community that saw a need and came together and put an organization together and implemented. Not did it only involve church members, but it involved Presbyterians and the Catholic diocese and other religions and other sects. And so that, I think, is really unique, and that's something that I think that as church members is something that we need to look at as maybe as an objective. The Wellesabugu Alliance does, in fact, involve the whole community here in Salt Lake City. It's just not, you know, the Mormons that are involved. And it is something that, you know, the church has taught me is to somewhat wing from the church and not wait for the organization, maybe perhaps, to tell us, or why isn't the church here? Why isn't the church doing development? And I would suggest, why aren't we doing it? Because that's what the church has taught us, I think, to do, is to help those people that are less fortunate than us, not only, you know, physically, but in other areas that exist emotionally and other ways also. Development is a very... I guess it's simple, but when we were in Wellesabugu and met with the USAID director over there, he gave us some statistics that were startling, and I was a little bit upset about them. There are more PVOs in Africa right now than there were 20 years ago. PVO is a private voluntary organization like the Wellesabugu Alliance, Save the Children, Oxfam, etc. There are more there now than there were 20 years ago, but the situation is worse. It's not better. And he just said, but keep on trucking, keep on going. And I said, yeah, okay. Something's not working. You know, you can say it's working, but something isn't. But it is working at the same time. A very good example is when we got off the plane into Wellesabugu, Bamako, Mali. I got off the plane. I'd never been there, and I'd been working on the project for a year and a half. And I looked around and saw so much poverty. I just thought, this is a joke. I'm going home. I'm not going to try. I mean, we can't do anything. Just off the plane into the capital was startling. I thought that for about 3 or 4 days, and thought, well, you know, let's call a spade, and you know, go home and make money, not do this. So anyway, we went into a village, Bamakoni, which did not have any wells. They did not have water there. And the Wellesabugu Alliance, the community here in Salt Lake, raised the money, and we were enabled to help them put in 2 wells in that village. Before then, the women were walking 5 miles for water and also for food, because they couldn't grow food because the water wasn't there. So we went to put a plaque on the 2 wells when we were there, and the village chief thanked us very much, and there was a woman there that talked to us, and in her Bambara, she said, you know, there's no way in the world, you know, we could have put these wells in, and we were walking 5 miles for water, we were walking 5 miles for food, and you could just see 5 feet away from the well that had been dug that there was a big garden plot, and they were in the work of putting in their own private little garden plots. And that was, you know, really neat to see. And at that point I said, well, yeah, it is working, because we've changed these 250 people in this village, we've changed their lives literally and established a very simple economic base where they can take the food now and possibly trade it for those things that they need. So it is working, and it's not. So I guess that's the paradox of life, and I think my personal opinion, and maybe it's showing a lot of my lack of knowledge, but I think that development has a long way to go. I think that, and I may be wrong, this is an opinion, that development is where maybe psychology was 100, 150 years ago. We have a lot to learn. I think a lot of other disciplines need to be channeled into development. I think we need more strong business people. I think we need to look at the political scientists. I think we need to look at the psychologists. I think we need all of those disciplines, you know, focusing on development and helping in that way. if I can give you some of my feelings why I think there are people in the world that go to bed hungry and children that don't make it to age 14. I was brought up thinking that it was always the weather, that they didn't have any rain, and that's why that they're in the situation that they're in. Not necessarily so. Maybe that's one variable involved, but there's several things that are happening. I think that lack of leadership in those countries and how those countries have been exploited, being sold as slaves. I think that corrupt government and power and all of those things are elements that cause the situations that now exist. When we were in Mali, I talked to a gentleman named Salif Keita, who was a famous soccer player in England, came and went to school here at the United States and went back to Mali and is living there with his family. And he said, please go to your congressman, help us. I think it's $10 million or maybe a little more that the United States gives to Mali. And it is a fact that their government is corrupt. Modibo Diarra, our facilitator over there, you know, has given, you know, numerous examples of how corrupt it is. And you can see it when you're over there. The people... The president has a banana field over there, and he takes his bananas to the market. Now, nobody else can sell their bananas until his bananas are all gone, and then they can sell their bananas. It is corrupt, and I think that's the last thing Salif said to me when we were leaving. He said, please, you know, go, you know, help us. Please go to your, you know, congressman and tell him what's going on. We need your help. So I think... you know, to sum things up, I think what we are doing on a grassroots in regards to going in there and getting them the water, getting them the medical help, the education, on a sustaining projects that are sustainable, so when we leave, those projects continue on. That's very important. But on the other side, I think we need to, and you're playing hardball, you're in big stakes when you start dealing with the government. But to really make a significant change, I think that you need to do that. I think that, and it's in the scriptures all over the place, where it talks about power, it talks about pride, selfishness. I think all of those things are many reasons why they're in the situation that they're in. I think that... you know, Africa has they're the richest continent with natural resources here on this world that we live in, and it just doesn't make sense. But it seems to me, and our government is also responsible, but I think that third and fourth world countries have been exploited. I think that, you know, we have gone in, and as country, we take the resources and we give a little bit back to them, but most of the time the money goes back to our United States. And I think that we need to reevaluate that. And I think it's going to take people that are not in it for money and are willing to make an economic base for the people in that country. Is he coming? He's not coming. He's not in his house. Do I have to talk longer now? Okay, I've lost my train of thought. Let me think. Anyway, I've lost my train of thought when everybody was coming in. Sorry. I guess the other thing, too, is it's very important. So you're working two sides of infrastructures, especially with the Walesa-Bugu Alliance or any other PVO. You've got the organization here in the United States, which is trying to, you know, it's an engine and a money-making thing, trying to get the money to make the operation work in Walesa-Bugu, Mali, wherever you choose to help. And that brings the question of sustainability. And in the long run, how is that going to help, and how is that going to make these people, you know, if you just give them a handout, you know, you're not helping. That's the other thing. You have to, I think everybody's a good person and everybody wants to help. And sometimes, out of goodness, we don't help because we don't know better. And sometimes, you know, that's something that's very frustrating because there's quite a few people that know development that are helping with Walasabugu, and then there are some that are not, but they're good people and they want to help. And that's a very difficult to deal with. So I think that sustainability and helping them become self-sufficient is important. I think it's important that you know, that the project here in Salt Lake continue to be, as it is now, the Walasabugu Alliance, focused and out of the structure of levels and able to, as directly as possible, get the monies and the decisions over to Molly. It's very difficult because I think that you sometimes deal with the elements of again, power and people wanting to make money off your organization, and that happens all the time. I get people calling and saying, I want to go dig a well. I charge $20,000 a year, and you know, and I mean, I get those. Well, you guys don't even know how these phone calls I get, and you know, people that want to do this and that. So I think it's I think that doing things for the right reasons is very, very important. Let me think if I have anything else to say. I don't think I do. I lost my train of thought, and so anyway, I'll let Dave Knowlton, you know, talk now and propose some questions. Thank you.
It's unfortunate that the other speaker did not show up today, and so since I'm in the official role of a commentator, I would just like to say that professional responsibility requires that a speaker at least let people know if they're not going to be there. One could speak endlessly about the lack of professional responsibility in almost any field, but I don't want to do that. However, that's not my purpose in standing here. I had originally intended to comment upon the presentations that were given. It's very hard, however, to comment on personal perspectives, because what you've seen in the two speakers is a great depth of feeling, and in the case of the Walasabugu Alliance, a great depth of action. People are actively trying to do something. It's very easy to find things to critique. I'm a professional intellectual. If I can't find something to critique about something, you know, that's my training. But one has to recognize and laud the importance of activity, of somebody actively attempting to do something to address a very difficult and a very thorny problem. I think that Kristen raised some very, very good issues. I'd like to start with the latter issue, one of her latter issues. Development is directly a result of politics. One cannot do development in the absence of a political context. Any kind of program occurs within a set of policy options, within a set of power interests that may indeed be contradictory to the program, may lead to the dissolution of the program. Politics, power, need to be taken into account. They have to be actively enter into our planning. Now, generally, when we in North America consider poverty, we think of it in a very unique way, something that is particular and peculiar to the North American milieu and the North American culture. We generally tend to think of poverty, and this is something I think that comes from our Puritan heritage, We generally think of poverty to be something as a matter of individual responsibility. If I am poor, perhaps it is because I have not worked hard enough. Now, if only I had gotten an education, if only I had taken that job opportunity that was offered, if only, then I wouldn't be poor. So that when we see poverty within society, we often tend to see it as a matter of individual morality, something that is incumbent upon the individual to resolve. Yet, we just heard somebody who's actively involved in development who brought out very clearly that to solve the problems of the hungry, to solve the problems of the needy, indeed to fulfill the responsibilities incumbent upon us as members of the Lord's kingdom, we need to take into account the larger context, the political context, and that indeed poverty is a result of particular political circumstances. And unless you address those particular political circumstances, poverty is unsolvable. Day before yesterday, I was in Lima, Peru. Lima is a massive metropolis of more than 6 million people. Specific figures are impossible to get on a city of such activity. It's like just a beehive, ever proliferating beehive of activity is Lima. Yet when I arrived in that city, there was hardly any electric light anywhere to be seen. Lima is normally covered by a gray cloud coming off the ocean, so the sunlight is always a little gray. But day before yesterday, it was grayer than ever, because you didn't have the lights in individual houses to punctuate the darkness. As a result of the lack of electricity, there was no bread to be found in the city. That meant that the millions of children in Lima's poor neighborhoods who live upon a couple of pieces of bread, a few rolls a day, were not having their nourishment. What was the cause of the lack of light? The conflict between the guerrillas and the government. The guerrillas had just knocked out the major electric lines coming from the mountains to the city. But let me stress that suffering is a result of poverty. Yet in Lima, if I can make a metaphor, there was a light of tremendous activity, a very vital and effervescent light occurring in the poorest neighborhoods of that tumultuous city. Surrounding Lima are probably about half the population lives in what are called, in the metaphors of the area, the euphemisms, young towns. They're really slums of ramshackle shacks that have been put up in hopefulness by people coming to the city, fleeing rural poverty, attempting to find help in the city, seeking urban services. Amongst the immense and incredible poverty of those young towns, a poverty that you can't even begin to imagine unless you've seen it, a poverty that breaks your heart every day you're there, is a light of incredible activity. Unfortunately, that light does not occur near Mormon chapels. That light of activity is occurring around Catholic lay workers, around Catholic missionaries, around the structures that used to be the ones of domination and oppression within Latin America, namely the Catholic institutions. Since Vatican II, the Catholic Church has become a model of anti-poverty activity in Latin America, so-called liberation theology. That's almost a bad word in the United States because of certain American Catholic writers who have attacked it. But when you live and work in Latin America, you have to encounter that social activism every day. And if you're at all a religious person, you listen to the activists, you hear their intense spirituality, you feel it, and you know that you are seeing Christianity in action. Suddenly, as Tricia said, politics and religion don't matter. What matters is the Christian obligation to help the needy. But, as I said, it cannot happen in a vacuum. Individual activity is important. It's very important for all of us to become educated about the issues, to become actively involved in development. But it cannot happen in a vacuum. I think that the Catholic Church's experience can serve as a guide to us. Now, what we're seeing in the Catholic movement in Latin America is not something that issued from Rome. In fact, Rome has been systematically fighting against it, if I might say so. What we're seeing is something that is issued instead from the works of individual religious and lay Catholic thinkers, works that have captivated the Catholic force in Latin America, the popular force as well, and led to a total revitalization. Let me give you one fact. Catholicism is growing by leaps and bounds right now as an official missionary force among the poor of Latin America, almost the majority of that continent. Our church, despite our impressive gains, is not growing among that population. We are growing instead among upper, middle class and upper lower class people. By and large, we are not addressing the needs of the poor, be they working poor or non-working poor in Latin America. And our church suffers in comparison to the vitality of the Catholic institution. What is it that Catholicism has done? Beginning with Vatican II in Latin America, they chose to make a preferential option for the poor. What that means is that the church would actively look at its role in the social order. It would realize that its function in the social order was a matter of morality, was a matter of responsibility. And that that morality obliged them, as Christians, to take the needs of the poor seriously. So that instead of becoming a support merely for the social orders it then was, the Catholic Church became a critical force within society. A force that would actively question and challenge social inequities when they were seen. Actively attempt to root out the causes of poverty as they saw them. Another thing the Catholic Church did, something that was new, they gave the scriptures to the people. Actively encouraged the people to get involved in reading the gospel. You know what the most revolutionary text in Latin America has been over the last few years? Forget Karl Marx. You know, Karl Marx, although maybe the official leader or the official ideology of most guerrilla movements, has not been the vital active revolutionary force. And instead it has been Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The priests or missionaries have encouraged the local Christians to get together in what are called base communities, where the people would read the scriptures and actively attempt to locate them within their own lives. Do as Nephi said, see how the scriptures can serve or give a guide or relationship to their own life. What has happened out of that is the development of a social gospel, something that comes right out of the roots of Mormonism, yet we're silent. A social gospel that argues that temporal salvation is important for spiritual salvation. It argues that our position within the social order and the implied morality of that social order also becomes important for our spiritual salvation. As a result, the people in the base communities have been strongly working to improve their own situation. Self-help. Another very important Mormon principle. With the resources of the Catholic Church, they've developed a commitment to educate themselves, to improve themselves, to bring water to their neighborhoods, and so on. It's also led to a political challenge, I will admit that. There's a problem of people getting educated. They often then want to challenge the political order that surrounds them. I think that since we're basically a religious group, that it's incumbent upon us to study the Catholic model. As Mormons, we're not an ecumenical group. But yet I think that something new has happened within the Catholic Church. Again, something that hasn't come from the Vatican, but something that's developed spontaneously, almost out of the masses of the people. And it's something that speaks very loudly to Christians who are actively engaged in Latin America. But yet it's something that we as Mormons are generally silent on. If our religion is to mean something, it can only mean something through our activity. Through our activism. Now, there are many ways of doing development. There are formal groups, informal groups. There are the kinds of individual organizations such as the Andean Children's Foundation here in Salt Lake, the Wallace Abugu Alliance. There are the development activities that occur as a response of our own tax dollars. But I think the most important thing, and again something that comes from the Catholic model, is for us to educate ourselves. Not merely in the pragmatic thing of how do we improve a well. That as well. But how do we change the social circumstances that lead to poverty? How do we remove that scourge from the world? For where one man suffers, all men suffer. And again, I think the Catholic Church is a model. Because here in the United States, many Catholics from the wealthiest nation on earth have taken seriously their Christian responsibility, organized study groups and organized support groups, again, independent of the official hierarchy of the church. Metal connections. Perhaps sanctioned by the institutional connection with the Catholic Church, but nonetheless, very direct communications from people to people that are contributing directly to improving the situation. Now, many of the large-scale problems cannot be changed except for by governmental large-scale action. But I think in this forum, it's enough for now to stress the importance of our commitment as individual Christians individual children of our Father in Heaven to our brothers and sisters in the rest of the world, no matter their religion, no matter their creed, and realize that we are either part of the solution or part of the problem, such as the reality of a political context. Perhaps we might look to the scriptures as well for guidance, as have the people of the base communities in Latin America. There's much more that could be said, but I think I'll leave you with my little speech and turn the time back over to Tricia.
I'd like to thank very much our two panelists. Dave just became a panelist from a commenter. We have about a half hour left for questions and answers, but before we start that, I'd like to call someone up from the audience to participate on our panel. I mean, this is like sacrament meeting when you have a program and no names, right? So, Joe Black. Dr. Joe Black has spent his career in international development, and last time I saw Joe, he asked me to speak at one of his things, and so I'm just returning this. Only he was more polite than I am. He gave me advance notice. No, actually, we talked about this at the beginning of the meeting. Joe, do you have anything you want to say, or would you just like to be part of the...
I have some questions.
Oh, questions.
No,
okay.
I'll comment here.
Okay, great. Thanks.
You see, you have to be very careful in these meetings and not be a high priest and just go to sleep. Because all at once you find you're being called on either to give the closing prayer or something. I don't know which it was you wanted. But I am going to address a couple of questions. I have been involved in development programs. Before retiring and coming back here, the last 5 years was in Indonesia. Before then, many years in Africa and elsewhere, working a lot of the last several years with the Rockefeller Foundation on overseas development programs. But as I was listening to the comments here, some questions did come to my mind that I would like to raise and let our panelists here who are prepared respond to them. Tricia, in her opening comments, talked about the church and the fast we had for what was happening in Ethiopia and so on and the response that was made. She didn't talk about how much that the church's response really came from members calling the church and asking why we were not doing something. What has interested me over the last 2 or 3 years since that occurred, given what's happening in the Sudan, in Somalia, in Ethiopia and elsewhere, that we've moved into another great disaster, but not one word has been said about it. I have wondered why we don't either quicken our fast or lengthen our fast or do something else. When we say there's not so much money available, I have wondered, once there was that successful fast that month, why it did not become either a biannual thing or an annual thing or a monthly thing. To really alert people to the significance of this as an organized group, you can contemplate in this church, what kind of funds could have been raised if that were a high priority? I recall giving a talk once, or some lessons once, in my ward, and I raised the question of our being our brother's keeper, the very questions that are being raised a moment ago here about our individual responsibility. And someone said, well, Brother Black, you know what the threefold mission of the church is, and the one that you're talking about on either helping with the development in developing countries or the poor is just simply not our threefold mission at all. So are you contesting the whole thing of what our focus is? You are saying that we should be concerned about being our brother's keeper or helping with Africa or development or even in our own communities. Just remember now what the threefold mission is, and let's not, unless we get advice, I said, well, perfect the saints. You know, the threefold mission for you who are members, the missionary work, temple work, and perfect the saints. If the saints are to be perfected, really, maybe we have to be more concerned about our brother's keeper or doing something else. But then the point was made to me, don't you know that to perfect the saints really means to get them worthy for their own endowments? I mean, that's what the perfecting of the saints means. It doesn't mean spending our time or our money helping the poor in Africa or in Salt Lake City or someplace else. So I would like to raise the question, and then I'll do one other, and then I'll sit down. I really wanted to hear Jim today, too, on especially raise some questions on Egypt. But I would like to have Trish respond to that, because when we talk in this conference here about having our voices heard and having an input, I know that when an authority can travel and say, we raised this money and here's the results of it, to me the amount spent on new carpets for our chapels exceeds by 1,000 times what was going on. As our new carpet was replaced, and so I ask, is there any defect in the carpet that's on the floor right now? No, it's just our turn. I said, if you can think about the amount of funds that might be needed for something else, maybe we have to re-describe what the make it a fourfold mission of the church to also be sure that we have good new orange carpets or whatever. I don't know. But anyway, how do you have more response? Now, this broadens it just a little bit. Where some people say, well, the individuals can do things. Why do you talk about the church? I belong to many groups here in Utah that are concerned with a lot of social things, and am president of the United Nations Association of Utah. I am surprised in the groups that I belong to how many of those are from a small number of people who are outside of the Mormon church or the Mormon mainstream. I mean, you go to the meetings of these churches, it is not the church group that is there at all. Or if you try to organize a United Nations Day program, find out how you get the notices of that around. It's very interesting. So I am interested both in individual responsibility and what we do individually, in PVOs, private voluntary organizations, and everything else that we do. I think there is a responsibility, and I agree with those scriptures. And that great speech by Fowler yesterday of talking about the challenges ahead of us, it is just incredible in our own country to see the group at the bottom getting poorer while we have more billionaires at the top. So I think there are responsibility. I was told by someone, it is demeaning to those at the top to call them millionaires anymore. That is not what counts. They're billionaires. So I think that we have both the individual responsibility, family responsibility, community responsibility, but I also put it very strongly, and political, to let our voices be heard with our politicians. But finally, I would also say, inside of our organized religion, I think there is much that is being done, but I think there is much more that we can do to let people know. I am so amazed how the world found out about the starvation going on in Ethiopia, because something was uncovered by the British Broadcasting Company, and all at once the world was alerted. But oh, the dwindling of compassion the last 3 or 4 years, as we have had what is going on in the Sudan and elsewhere, or in parts of Latin America. So the challenge is here. And if anyone is realistic on projecting through the 90s some of the problems of development that have to take place in our own country and elsewhere, the challenges are enormous. And so without, I've spoken much too long for having just walked in the room and not being prepared at all, but I am interested deeply in this topic, and it's been a part of my life for many, many years. So there are some things here that other people may want to respond to, but maybe I'm just in the wrong part of the valley, but I do not hear very much concern. We talk about what went on the last conference. I don't see any speeches that really alerted us to the problems of disparity throughout the world and what our responsibilities are to our fellow men. And I would like to at least raise that flag very high. Thank you.
Thank you. Joe, can you join us up here? Joe, can you join us up
here?
Well, I'll sit over here
kind of as a
part. Okay. Are you still fair game for questions, okay?
I'd like to
respond to this. Okay, thanks very much for your comments. I'll address the question that Joe just brought up on the threefold mission of the church and how to take care of the poor in other parts of the world call. I think I would like to add a fourth mission to the church, and that is, I'm making my own. that is to follow the first and great commandment, that is to love the Lord and love your fellow man and love yourself.
because I see as the motivating factor if we really want to get involved in international development. There are a lot of reasons why, and I've seen a lot of people motivated by different things that are working in this kind of an activity. Sometimes they're curious about other cultures, sometimes it seems kind of exotic, or it seems like a great thing to do, and it's a thing that get involved in, but I think really the only truly fulfilling kind of motivation for doing this type of work is that it's love, it's based by love, that great love for Heavenly Father's children, not only those that we know, but those that we don't know, those that we know have great needs. And that seems to me, if that were one of the four missions, that it would cover this idea of getting involved in programs, ideas and incentives to help
people
in the world.
Yeah, I have a few things that I'd like to say. What Brother Black just spoke rings very deeply, very loudly to my ear. Certainly it goes along with with my own thinking about the issue. I think it's sad that within the church, the notion of morality has been limited to a very, very circumscribed, narrow definition of morality. Almost the kinds of things that go into a temple interview. Without real careful thought about what goes into honesty and our dealings with our fellow man, nor the issues of institutional and social morality around us. It's also sad that the church has removed itself from social activism in so many ways. Tricia, to begin with, spoke about two programs we're involved in. What about the many we've quit being involved in? At a time when every religious group in Bolivia is building schools, we closed ours. We had schools only in Chile and Bolivia. Why did we have them there? Because the members demanded and the government obliged. When the obligations were off, we closed them because of the expense that was involved in educating the children of the members of the church as opposed to missionizing new members. We used to have hospitals to take care of the needy. Most missions in Latin America are once again opening hospitals at a time when the government can no longer care for its people because of the international debt crisis. Health of people around the world is worsening. Religious groups are recognizing their obligation and moving forward. Ours, sorry, we're silent. The church does not merely depend on revelation from the Lord. It depends on the collective will of the people. As Brother Black said, it depends on the people actively encouraging the officialdom of our organization to move. And I think if we want to see a greater collective response, it's kind of incumbent upon us to speak in fora like this, as well as my grandfather used to do in personal letters to the general authorities, to let them know our feelings on the issues. But I think the Brother Black was absolutely right, that it's a shame that Mormons are not more involved. When I lived in Austin, Texas, we had a massive 100-year flood. Everybody in the town was organizing to get out and help one another. Now, the press made a big deal about it in Utah when we had our floods in 84, was it? How everybody got together and collectively sandbagged. But where were the Mormons in Austin? In their homes with their families, or in the churches and their organizations. Our church was absent from the getting together of the community to help solve problems. We as Mormons have turned inwards. We're like a tortoise. We live in our chapels and our congregations. As Brother Black says, I know that if you were to poll the organizations actively involved in social service, social development, just in our own city, you'd find a much greater representation of non-Mormons than you would of Mormons. In the ones that I've seen or been involved in, there are very, very, very few Mormons. We're involved in building up Zion. Our Zion of our own little homes, our suburbs up here, our houses on the hill, our nice chapels with orange carpet. But we're not actively involved in building up a Zion of all humanity or all mankind. We've too narrowly defined the kingdom of God. And since I know that I could go on making this speech forever and ever, I think I'll draw it to a close there and let Kristen comment.
That's really good work. I don't know.
Yes, recording.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we could open it to questions then as well, and comments from the audience.
Yeah, he's in the area presidency right now in Great Britain. Is that right? Yeah. Alex Morrison. Wondering what the background is on Elder Morrison, Alexander Morrison. And for several years, I know he was involved in the World Health Organization. And I'm not too sure after that. But I have heard him give talks on the health of the world, which have been very insightful, very depthful.
He's over at
Yeah, and
Kurt. So he really is involved in that area. Yeah.
Yeah. Working with Africa. Okay, you had a question.
Well, I'm going to add sort of an example of what things from love. I was really happy to hear about this Catholic grassroots thing and how can we change the Mormon church? Maybe that way. We're so into, I'm really a longer service missionary, and I saw this very thing happening where in Santa Cruz, where they told that the activity was wonderful, and they met in two little houses put together, and they kept wanting their chapel, and for some of them, a lot of money, the church, and that activity dropped off dramatically. And there was the example where they were beginning to feel their community within themselves, how it's going to come and do their thing. We perhaps trying to hear the church is just not doing its thing with which it teaches, which is about the health of self. I mean, you don't need the building to practice the gospel, and maybe we can get that turned around.
I do know that in the Philippines right now that they are aware of that, and they are aware that in many countries they are looked upon as this rich religion that is building chapels. And in Philippines they're establishing a program right now where they're just going into the homes and they're having their meetings in their homes and other buildings. They want
In Bolivia, Mary, the new policy is what I heard from people in the church office building in Bolivia. New policy is coming down about construction as a result, in part, of the bombings of Mormon churches throughout Latin America, as well as of the unfortunate death of two missionaries by the guerrillas. And that is to build less luxurious buildings. Now, you know, our buildings here may fit in. Yet Wednesday evening I was meeting with a group of Bolivian scholars and we were discussing why Mormons had been so singled out for attacks by the guerrillas across the continent. And the reason, in part, that they told me, they said, well, let me ask you a question. Are Mormon chapels so luxurious everywhere? Do they stand out? Okay, guys, they're just cinder block constructions. They're really nothing neat. But it's the context. We are doing today what the Catholic Church did 200 years ago, building gilded structures while the people starve. And Mary, still there's a problem with the Church's policy. If I can be so bold as to criticize, there's a policy problem with the Church's policy. It's that we're not letting the people build their own chapels. Now, I remember when I was growing up in El Paso, Texas, we suffered in our ward to build a chapel. We starved and sweated. Well, starved, okay, I'm exaggerating. We sweated anyway. We went a little hungry at times to put money into the building fund. But the thing is, we did it. We were laborers on the force. I was, you know, a preteen, and I remember getting up there on the rafters trying to help do things. I don't know anything about carpentry. I certainly didn't then. But we, as a membership in the church, tried to do it. It built a sense of community. But in Latin America and the rest of the world, we don't encourage our people to do that. We have professional builders who come in and set up the churches for them. So it's no wonder activity declines. It's no wonder. We don't encourage the sense of Christian community. But let me make one further comment, since I'm the verbose one today. The other comment is, I don't think it's necessarily incumbent upon the church. I think the institutional church needs to move, yes. But it'll find its way. I have faith. The Lord will help it and move it on its way. But there's another church that's equally important. That's the body of believers. That's us. We don't have to wait for an instruction to come down from 50 East North Temple. We can do like Preston and get together right now and do something. Start individually becoming committed. And as we speak out, as we work Mormons then are doing things. It requires nothing more than getting involved in community organizations here locally in the Valley. You know, it's interesting. I don't know if you know the demography of distribution of Mormons, the geography of distribution of Mormons in the Valley. The central city and west side are solidly not the poor areas. Mormons are aggregated along the benches and in West Valley, the new booming middle-class suburbs and the upper middle-class suburbs. Why is there this disjunction in Utah, where the services for the poor, the needy of Salt Lake City are in the hands of Catholic Community Services or in the hands of other groups, when we are not actively out taking care of our roads? We'll send missionaries, but do we send the Relief Society with cakes and casseroles when they need? Or do we send the home teachers to go and help mow lawns or to paint or to build?
Okay. Well, we try to pass this down so we can get the questions recorded off. I want to explore this idea of the Catholic model being one for us as Mormons. And what I want to do is maybe focus it a little bit differently from what I see. Because the things that you pointed out in the latter part were the ideas of having lay leadership and organization, of having the scriptures among the working with those types of things. And I think if in my experience, those were things that I would say that we've been successful at for a long time. Maybe not in quite the same formulation, but those are some of our strengths that I think the Catholic Church in Latin America is coming onto. And in fact, we could be an example to them. But the strength, the one point that you made is that in terms of Vatican II and the Medellin Conference, that people will find this saying, we have become the Church of the Rich, and we have become the Church, the Catholic Church, that is supporting the political structure that exists and is creating the status of poverty in the country. Mm-hmm. And we need to become the Church of the oppressed and promote that, mm-hmm. and which has caused major disruptions. Mm-hmm. And so when I look at what I would want to emulate from the Catholic model, my focus would be more on that piece of it. And you might talk about this more in your session later today, but the thing that I find is sort of an obstacle is that in our development work, we are sort of have the precedent of the missionary work, and since the missionary work in particular now is suffering from political pressures and oustings and assassinations and things like that, we are going to be even more hesitant to take on the political power structures in mm-hmm. these countries. And it's kind of like, as an individual, I feel like I can't do much about that, and I'm just wondering what you think.
Well, the old idea is to think globally and act locally, which means that in our own individual ways, if we think in terms of the total solution to the problem, or the total problem, we can do things, but it requires a collective effort. I think, Jolene, you're absolutely right in pointing out that what the Catholic Church is doing today is good old-fashioned Mormonism like my grandma used to preach. It's not, however, the active current reality of Mormonism. If there's an irony in this, it's that the Catholics are better Mormons than we are. If there's an irony in this, it's that the Catholic Church is discovering the good old-fashioned doctrine of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young at a time when we are discovering the good old-fashioned doctrine of the Holy See of Rome. We are becoming the Church of the affluent, or the ones who wish to be affluent and emulate the affluent. We don't let people have their own, you know, their responsibility for themselves. We bring heavy manuals from Salt Lake and say, okay, now this is the way you are to run your ward, here's the way you're to account for it, and so on. Where the people have to learn to fill this model instead of growing in their callings and working, feeling a sense of self-responsibility. The missionaries carefully push them and shield them and bring them into membership. Then they're nestled in a church bureaucracy that carries them along. That although there's lay responsibility, in some ways it's not that different than the old Catholic hierarchical model. And if there's something that really does come out of Vatican II, it's the notion of self-responsibility and on the notion of the Gospels, to which we can add Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Nephi as important models for social activity. Mosiah and Nephi are downright revolutionary texts. Marx has nothing as vital or as critical as what's found in 4th and 3rd Nephi and in Mosiah, Mosiah's in King Benjamin's speech. And I think that the institutional church has its rationality and its need to become just the threefold doctrine. It may need to back away. Brother Black shakes his head. I'll grant them they may need to. I think they should change as well. But on the other hand, we as members also have a responsibility to rein it in and say, hey, we have more responsibility elsewhere. And we as members have a responsibility to try to act as well. That, unfortunately, we're not doing on the whole. There are a few nice lights, but there aren't many.
The Perfecting the Saints part of the program of the church is this program. It is, you know, the humanitarian, you know, service to all mankind. And it is the missionary. Stand up. That is, you know, that is our responsibility. It is written into our liturgy, into our scriptures, into the comments by general authorities. You know, it's just we don't want to look at it. And in fact, the institutional church doesn't want to look at it. To quote a Mexican state president, I wish you would stop sending, Don Luther quoted this, you know, last year. You know, I wish you would stop exporting your neurotic bureaucracy and let us live the gospel. Type of thing, which is basically saying, you know, we don't need the expensive chapels, we don't need that kind of stuff. What we need is to get out with our people and, you know, work and worship together and solve the social problems that we have, because the social problems are church problems. Those are the problems of the gospel, of loving one another and bringing that to it. I just wanted to maybe ask, you know, why don't we just, you know, there are those of us here, and those of us who are here because we have an interest in it. Why don't we get like a list, you know, what can we do here? You know, what's the next step that we do? You know, maybe list it on the board. You know, what are these next steps that we have to take to instigate, you know, our own, you know, projects? One last comment. There are within, you know, not within the institutional church things happening. I know, you know, that there are little things that come in that don't get any publicity, they don't get, people don't know about. And I just want, you know, I know that there are things that happen. Like within our ward, you know, somebody, you know, had this idea. He served a mission in Guatemala or Colombia, I forget, one of the two countries down there. And he just organized a little, you know, project and basically invited our ward to help contribute to this little project that he was associated with, and basically just had it within our ward saying, anybody who wants to contribute, it costs $300 to build, you know, a house. Basically, the only thing we provide for the people is you know, availability of materials so they can build a cinder block house rather than a cardboard house. You know, it's not anything fancy. It's a cinder block house with a tin roof, and it's, you know, it's small. It's about the same size as their, you know, cardboard house. But anybody who's willing to contribute, and our ward, you know, everybody, you know, a lot of people contributed and got this down, and he took the money down because he works internationally, also, and he keeps going back. Because he works for a company that has, you know, things down there, and he took the money down, and then he brought back reports occasionally, you know, that, yeah, there were three houses built, you know, over this last year, because, you know, the members in our ward contributed, you know, to this little project that he had going. And, you know, so things can happen, but they have to happen with individuals, and the institution is moves really slowly. You know, it's, you know, anyway, that's the end of that. So why don't we make a list of the next steps?
Yeah. Thanks. I think that's a good idea. Being a teacher, why don't we use the board and write some things on the board, as Royden suggested. Does anyone have any ideas of things that, you know, you think are viable? Yeah.
I want to make a comment on a couple of things, but one was related to that. I might mention I had an interesting exchange of letters with Jeffrey Hall in the BYU not too long ago when I made some suggestions on how BYU could be a lot more involved in international development. I got the response. He said the church feels that they can convert people
the Spirit will work with them, and that'll take care of the development. So that was the explanation that I had. There are several levels that we can work. There's the what we call NGOs, non-government organizations, such as she's working with. There's two groups that I've been associated with. One of them is called the Global Tomorrow Coalition. The other is called GlobeScope. I don't know if you're familiar with them or not. That are really groups of organizations that work with other countries. And they take the theme, as you mentioned, to think globally, or think globally and act locally. But by combining efforts and interchanging information, it makes them a lot more effective because they can interact easily. Another level is one which most people here will not be involved in, but I am. I'm currently working on a research program on ecology in India and spent 4.5 years in the Middle East. But working with the long-term management of resources, which in Africa is one of the real needs in Sudan and other areas to look at this. And a third level is just to write letters not only to the church but also to your congressman. There's a couple of bills in Congress, one in particular, that would divert more of the foreign aid to projects by women and also small business projects in other countries. And it's an opportunity to try and pressure for passage of this, which would fund many of these programs that now don't get it. As he noted, much of our foreign aid goes to these countries, and then they have to turn around and spend it back here in the United States, and the emphasis is on big programs like dams and roads and the like, whereas much of the real development comes locally with small projects, and these bills would fund additional projects in different countries, particularly the emphasis on the projects started by women.
Thank you. I think that a lot of people do get frustrated because, I don't know if you're like me, but, you know, you get these letters all the time asking for donations for all these, you know, different kinds of international projects, and you feel like, yeah, these are worthwhile, but how do we get involved in a worthwhile, something that will be worthwhile, and something that we can get, you know, reward from that will be worthwhile on the other end. So we have suggestions were to get involved in some kind of NGO or PVO. Now, those two that you mentioned, are those? Do they have local affiliates here in Utah?
I don't know. They do not. Both of them, the Global Tomorrow Coalition is a group of it's about 180 different groups of various kinds. They have headquarters in Washington. The GlobeScope is an organization started originally to bring people together to communicate with each other and exchange information. They now have 3 or 4 national conferences plus regional conferences for that purpose. But they have also been working very closely with the Global Tomorrow Coalition. So what I would expect is there's probably some organizations. The Audubon Society, which is here, is a member of the Global Tomorrow Coalition. Mm-hmm.
Great. Good. Right.
I have a suggestion.
Okay.
I just choose and move. Choose an organization that you would, you know, that you have an affinity with or for an area that, you know, maybe you feel like. Choose and then move. Join and then, you know,
and do something.
Activate and do something.
Okay. Choose and move. Good.
Bye. I have another one that I'd like to see on the list too.
Okay.
So I just choose and move, and that's when you're converting, convert your brother. You know, there's proselyte about development actively. We have a great Mormon tradition of study groups. It's kind of the Christian-based community thing. Study groups involved with the social gospel would be another important way of spreading the message.
Yes?
I guess it's something bothering me, and it's always bothering me about developing stuff or anywhere where white people go in and do anything. I'm living in Alaska now, and I live in Alaska, and you know, it's Alaska, and it's the epitome of what white people have gone in. First of all, they damaged the society, and now they're trying to put together the most famous, because you have to do it yourself. So it seems like when you go in and try and do something, maybe I have to become like Mother Teresa, not totally depriving myself of anything, everything, to live there. Feel it and become part of the organization, become part of the society. I know we can't try this fight, which is a great problem. But maybe we have to put aside our narrativeness or whatever it is,
What kind of net projects are, or even what